Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, Monday, March 11th. We are hearing only one bill this morning, but before we hear the bill, I would like to hear from Legislative Revenue Office some background information to help prepare us for hearing the public testimony. Mr. Easton.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Yes, and building off of a previous discussion with this committee related to our connection or how Oregon connects for tax purposes to the federal tax provisions. This is related to the personal income and the corporate income tax. I do have just a one pager up there in OLIS titled Federal Tax Connection. And again, it starts with the flow chart, so to speak, that this committee saw when discussing the Reconnect bill. But I wanted to touch on a couple things, the two boxes titled income and then adjustments to income, which are in some ways, or one way to think of it is they're further upstream from our current connection point. So again, as just a brief reminder, Oregon is using the federal taxable income is Oregon's connection point to the federal tax provisions. And then what the committee heard a little bit during the previous discussion of the connection is there's really two points to keep in mind in terms of a connection, and that is where to connect and then whether to do what's considered a rolling reconnect or the static connection. So in terms of where to connect, again, Oregon's been connected to the definition of federal taxable income for a number of years, back to the late 60s. But also other states, in many cases, there are a few that use federal taxable income, but the majority use adjusted gross income as the connection point. And the big difference there is if you connected adjusted gross income, it's upstream, so to speak, from those deductions, where because Oregon connects downstream of the federal taxable income, all the itemized deductions are more or less in Oregon's tax code automatically. Oregon has opted into those federal provisions. And then the secondary piece is whether to have a rolling reconnect or a static reconnect. And that's just whether or not Oregon is automatically connected or requires legislation annually to connect. Then that's the static connection. But in terms of even moving upstream from the adjusted gross income, you have the provisions related to income and adjustments to income. So all the definitions in the Internal Revenue Code that go into identifying what income is taxable, and that would include things where there are exclusions from income, where specific income has been deemed non-taxable, that flows through into Oregon as well due to our connection to taxable income, or if Oregon chose to connect it, adjusted gross income, AGI, those definitions of the income and adjustments to income, again, are still upstream from that. So those are embedded wherever you connect, whether it's AGI or federal taxable income. So the two tables below the flowchart there are the sources of income, which probably unsurprising, the number one there is wages is the largest, about 66%. Next is retirement, business, and then net capital gains. And that'll be part of the discussion you'll hear about related to the opportunity zones is related to that net capital gains. And then the smallest kind of rounded out there is the dividends and interest. So those are the sources of income that make up the income that starts as taxable. And then we have the adjustments to income, which is then amounts that are subtracted more or less from that income. And the largest three you see there are the self-employed health insurance, self-employment tax, and then the SEP and simple retirement plans. And those are really related to, these are going to be self-employed individuals that are the self-employed health insurance. That's akin to if you're an employee and your employer is covering all or part of your health insurance costs, the business can essentially write those costs off. So those are costs of the business. But for someone who's self-employed, to allow them to do more or less the same thing, they're allowed to have an adjustment to income, so they reduce their income by that amount of that self-employed individual is paying for their own health insurance. And that really is about, in some ways, treating the self-employed similar to as if they were an employee of an employer. But those are the first three, the self-employed, and that makes up about half of all the adjustments to income that were on the books, at least in tax year 2016.
Representative Finley.
Thank you, Chair. This form has changed. The last time we seen this chart a week and a half ago, it was different than this. The federal taxable income was at 88. What's the difference between the two?
Yeah, Rep. Finley, the year in which I was using, I had more information for the tax year 2016. So there's a little difference between the two, the numbers. So I've just changed the year in which they reference, and then I included the income and the adjustments to income. Okay. But I could line those up. And I think it might even be sources of income as well, where we're pulling this information from. And that is one thing to keep in mind on the income, the $118 billion, this is what's on the federal return. So in terms of the retirement, which accounts for about 14%, Oregon doesn't tax any Social Security benefits. So there's some Social Security benefits that are not taxable at the federal level. Oregon then allows a further subtraction of those. So that would even reduce a little bit to some extent the makeup of what we tax here in Oregon in terms of that income component. And that's something I should have mentioned ahead of time. This is what's coming in on the federal return that's coming with the Oregon return when someone files.
Thanks.
But again, rounding out the rest of the adjustments, the last point I'd make in the adjustments is in many ways these are referred to as deductions as well, but you might hear the term above the line deduction, which just means they're a deduction that someone can take without having to itemize their deductions. And that's one of the key things you'll hear sometimes where it's like, well, this is a deduction from income, and that's true, but there could be two deductions type, those that are itemized and those that are many times really labeled as adjustment. And it really is just that allowing someone who's not an itemized, someone who's taking the itemized deductions to benefit from these adjustments to income.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Easton? Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we're going to have one more bit of informational meeting from LRO.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. So I've provided some background information related to House Bill 2144. Just as a brief overview, House Bill 2144 proposes a disconnect from the Federal Opportunity Zone program. There are some issues with the language currently, but the intent is to disconnect from that program at the state level. So today, I will go through some background information briefly related to these zones. So the Opportunity Zone program, what does it look like in general? So first, it's part of the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And at the federal level, the US government defines eligible low-income communities and provides basically a list of these communities based on certain eligibility criteria. The two, most enforceable, or the way that most of these communities will qualify for eligibility, is that they have a poverty rate of 20% or higher, or the income level, the median household income of that area is less than 80% of the area, either like the metropolitan area or the state's median family income, less than 80% of that. So they designate eligible low-income communities at the federal level. And then at the state level, the governor in each state was given authority to designate a set of opportunity zones from the eligible low-income communities. So at the federal level, there's a list of eligible communities based on that criteria I mentioned. And then at the state level, governors were given the chance to designate some of those zones with the restriction that they could only designate 25% of the eligible number. So it's not possible to take every eligible zone and make it an opportunity zone. There is a restriction on the number. And so in general, this program provides a tax incentive for investment into these low-income areas, again, as defined earlier. So this is kind of a broad overview. And I'll talk about each of the tax incentives in detail in later slides. Briefly, I'd like to show you what these zones look like throughout the state. This is a map produced on Business Oregon's website, and they helped in designating these zones. As you can see, they vary in size. And so the most visible right now tend to be in more rural areas. So they are larger in space with less of a population. If you think about looking in the Portland or Salem area right now, the zones are actually so small geographically, it's difficult to see on this map. But to give you an idea of what these zones look like and how they're dispersed throughout the state. As an example, I've zoomed in on Salem using the same mapping technology, and you can see that so it's a little bit difficult to see. There's a black dot right below the center blue area, and that's where we are. So areas north of downtown, there's a small area in West Salem, and then a larger area over to the southeast. Same idea here, but this is for Portland area opportunity zones, the largest city in the state. And so you can see there are some in the downtown area, some over by the airport, and then in, I would think, more suburban areas moving outward. So this is what these zones look like in some cases geographically. Now I'm going to talk about how investment into a zone works. So if I'm an investor and I'm looking to put money into an opportunity zone, where can I put it or how does this work? So investors take money and as defined in the statute that created this program, they have to invest into what's called a qualified opportunity fund. Basically, this is a, so it has to be a corporation or partnership. And that corporation or partnership, I believe, has to have 90% of their activity focused on a low-income area. So this is kind of a broad definition. These can take a lot of forms. The most important takeaway right now is that based on the way the statute's written, this has to be set up as a corporation or partnership. So, for example, my understanding of the statute is that if I'm an investor, I could not directly buy a building, for example, under this program. I would have to invest in this fund, and then the fund invests in projects. And so there's three types of projects that are allowed under statute. There is qualified opportunity zone stock, interest in a qualified opportunity zone partnership, or a qualified opportunity zone property. And these are defined in depth at the federal level in statute. So broadly speaking, how does the investment work? Investors put money into this fund. The fund then selects projects to work on. So it's not a direct investor to project link. So now I'll talk about the tax incentives that are in place under this program. The first, so there are kind of three broad tax incentives or three sets of tax incentives that are frequently referenced with this program. The first is a deferred tax on capital gains. So I'm gonna go through an example of each one of these in depth.
Representative Smith.
Can we go back a slide? I'm trying to think about the practicality. By the way, thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me ask this question. I'm trying to think about the practicality of this slide from an economic development perspective. It almost seems as if investors know they have a project and then put money into the fund to implement the project.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. So one example I was given by someone in the legal community is of that sort, where I have an idea for a project, and so I kind of organize this fund. I create a fund and bring my investors in, and then I administer or get involved in this project.
So Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the way the slide shows is very accurate. But in practical terms, what happens in a community is investors decide they want to make an investment of a project of some nature. Then they work with their legal counsel and their CPA to institute the qualified opportunity fund. They put the money into it and then funnel it down to fund the project. I just want to get that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so the first tax incentive, broadly speaking, is a deferred tax on capital gains. And so investors, whatever amount they invest into this zone, it has to be capital gains income. They have 6 months to invest that capital gains income into the zone, and then they are able to exclude or defer this income from their federal taxable income until they sell their portion of their investment in the fund, or until 2026, whichever is sooner. So, for example, if I were to invest in this fund today, I invested $1 million and I plan to hold that for 10 years, when 2026 arrived, I would have to include my deferred capital gains into my federal taxable income. So it's not an unlimited deferral, there is this end date here. The second tax benefit is an increase in basis on my initial capital gain. I'm going to go through an example of this with numbers, but for now, think of capital gains as being equal to how much you sold an asset for minus your basis. And so this is a tax incentive because it's increasing the basis, and so that's going to decrease the amount of the capital gain. And then finally, the last of these three tax incentives is that the actual investment into the opportunity zone is basically not subject to capital gains tax when sold. So the statute's a little bit more complicated than this, and I'll talk about it in a second. But effectively, the investment that I make into the zone, when I sell my interest in that fund, I am not subject to capital gains tax at the federal level on this, and thus currently at the state level as well. And for the third point here, it does, in order to have this benefit, you are required to hold the asset for at least 10 years. So in the subsequent slides, I'll go through an example of each of those three, starting with number one. Remember, number one was this deferred tax on capital gains. So suppose a person sold stock January 1st this year, and they received $1 million in capital gains income. So that's their profit on that stock, basically. So for that capital gains formula I discussed earlier, we would need to know both the sale price and how much I paid for the stock. So I, for this person in this example, initially paid $3 million for the stock, and they sold that stock for $4 million. So we get this $1 million in capital gains. That's what I just talked through. So suppose this person then takes that $1 million within 6 months of the sale of that stock and invest that $1 million into an opportunity zone through one of these funds. Tax incentive number one means that if this person does this within 6 months and invests in a fund, they now exclude the $1 million from their gross federal income in the tax year that they made the investment. So this is the deferred capital gains portion. Okay, example of the second tax incentive. So the second tax incentive said that I'm gonna increase basis or that you can increase basis on your investment. If you hold it 5 years, you receive a 10% increase in basis, and 7 years gets you an additional 5%, so up to 15%. So using an example with numbers, suppose this person that we were talking about before, same investment, they hold that investment for 5 years and then sell the investment in the fund. They receive a 10% increase in basis. So remember, capital gains is equal to the sale price, subtracting away the basis. Based on the numbers I told you earlier, we've got $1 million in capital gains, but that was from the selling the stock for $4 million, subtracting away the $3 million that we paid for it. So under this tax incentive number two, we get a 10% increase in basis. So the way this works is we take our basis of $3 million, or an investor would take their basis of $3 million and then add 10% of the initial capital gains. So when I add numbers in here, we now have the sale price of $4 million subtracted by the initial basis of $3 million plus $100,000, and that $100,000 is 10% of the $1 million. So effectively, now our capital gains are $900,000, whereas before they were $1 million. So the effect of the second tax incentive, this increase in basis, is to effectively decrease the taxable capital gains under this program. If I have an example after my ending slide, in case you're interested, I've done the same thing for the 7 years, but what would happen is the taxable gains after 7 years decline to $850,000. It's the same process as before. So second tax incentive is this increase in basis. The third tax incentive has to deal with the investment into the opportunity zone. And so suppose that individual A, the same person we've been discussing, this investor holds that investment for 10 years or longer. Now, when they sell the investment, the basis becomes equal to the sale price. So effectively what will happen is that there's no capital gains income because we're going to increase the basis to make it equal to the sale price. So, same formula as before. Suppose that I sell my investment into this fund for $1.5 million after holding it for 10 years. The law states that upon that sale, after 10 years, whatever I sell this for, my basis equals that number. So if I sell for $1.5 million, my basis equals $1.5 million, and so thus I have no capital gains the way this is defined. So those are the three tax breaks. Briefly, I've made a slide that goes through for an Oregonian investing, same example as before, $1 million into an opportunity zone. What happens currently if there's no policy change, and then what happens under the intent of House Bill 2144. So under no policy change, and we've talked through some of this, this investor invests $1 million into an opportunity zone. They don't pay capital gain. They don't include those capital gains in their federal taxable income until they sell that portion, or they sell that investment, or until 2026. So we have this deferral. And if it's deferred at the federal level, like Kyle discussed earlier, it would then be excluded from federal taxable income and excluded for Oregon purposes as well. Then in 2026, I have to pay, I have to include this in my federal taxable income, but I receive that 15% basis discount. And so now that this amount is included in my federal taxable income in 2026, it's also included in my Oregon taxable income in the same time. And if I hold this investment for 10 years, so now it's 2029 in the example we've been talking through, and I sell my share of this fund, I pay no federal capital gains tax on that income because it's excluded from my federal taxable income. And so because of that exclusion, it's also excluded at the Oregon level. This is under no policy change. So House Bill 2144 for an Oregonian making this investment would, the intent of the bill is to add back the capital gains income excluded from federal income initially in the year of investment. Then in 2026, when this income, the deferred capital gains is included at the federal level, the bill would allow for subtraction for the amount that you were taxed on this tax year. So when we get to the second box, we're allowing a subtraction for what was included and added in the first box. And then after the 10-year period, this investor sells their share of the opportunity fund. They pay no federal capital gains tax on that income, but Oregonians would pay capital gains tax on the opportunity zone investment under the intent of this bill. And this is just for an Oregon taxpayer. So now I'll go through this for a non-Oregon taxpayer. So same example as before, a non-Oregonian invests $1 million. They hold the investment for 10 years. In this case, they would defer federal tax on capital gains income until the sale or 2026. That's that first tax benefit. In 2026, they pay capital gains tax on the deferred amount, but they don't pay any Oregon tax here because we do not tax non-resident capital gains income. So the point I want to get across on this slide is that under House Bill 2144, we're still not affecting, these taxpayers are not affected, but Oregon taxpayers are affected. In 2029, again, same federal benefit, but there's no Oregon tax on non-resident capital gains again. And so the bottom line here is that only Oregon taxpayers are affected by this disconnect currently. And that is all the background information I have for you.
Good. Are there questions on the background information? In a moment, we're going to open the public hearing. I'm hoping to open the public hearing by 9 o'clock. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question on there. I think there are 86 or something like that opportunity zones in Oregon. And I'm wondering how many have a fund developed already and how many are being invested in right now so that when we discuss 2144, I have an idea of who will be affected or how many investors will be affected.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I don't have that information currently, but I can work on getting timely information.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2144. You want to just quickly summarize, you sort of already have.
Sure.
Officially for the record now that we've opened the public hearing on the bill.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. This bill, House Bill 2144, requires an addition to federal taxable income amounts excluded and deferred from federal capital gains income in part or as part of this opportunity zone program. It also allows a subtraction in the year the deferred capital gains income is included in federal income, and it disregards the changes to basis that I mentioned in my presentation. There are some language issues, but I've described the intent of the bill there.
Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I thought of my question just as you were banging the gavel to open this so it can be part of this hearing. I just want to confirm that looking through those opportunity zone incentives, even though the third one about the investment not being subject to capital gains when it is sold, there will still at some point be a deferred tax on the capital gains. So what I'm trying to figure out is, could you somehow take that, you know, your deferral because you're investing it into this, and then you don't? And then you don't pay taxes on the capital gains you make from that, if you hold it for an amount of time. Could that negate your original having to pay a deferred tax on capital gains from item from the first bullet? Or is or does that, or am I overthinking this?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my understanding is that every investment will have to include that deferred amount at some point. So I believe the end date of 2026 tries to kind of force that. So even if you're holding it for 10 years before you sell that investment, your initial capital gains from the sale of stock that I mentioned in the example, that is still subject to deferred, but it's subject to capital gains taxation. It will have that discounted rate depending on how long you sell it due to that basis increase, but that initial money is taxed.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Assuming that in one or however many years the federal government doesn't extend that, you know, but of course that's something that we cannot foresee. But as of right now, worst case, in 2026, some amount of capital gains would have to be paid on that, even in that investment.
Okay. Charities and some members of the committee, yes, the initial money that is used to invest in the Opportunity Zone is, assuming no federal extensions in the future, is subject to taxation at that deferred rate. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, I do have one more. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's fine. You're just laying the groundwork for the opportunity for me to ask some questions.
Great. And then I just wanted to go into, so that, again, the third point of the incentive, the investment not being subject to capital gains when it's sold. If you just had money, that period, if you just had money to invest, regardless of it not being a capital gain necessarily, but if you just had money to invest and you invested it, you then could invest it into this, make the capital gains, and then not pay anything on that money.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my understanding based on federal statute is that the source of the initial investment must be capital gains income. So I do not believe that's the case.
Okay. Thank you. That's important to know. So these would be funds that would be completely funded by capital gains?
Yeah.
That's my understanding, and I will look through statute in a minute.
Okay.
I believe some of the answers and some additional information will come out during the public hearing. I'm also recalling a presentation we had in the fall from Business Oregon, and some of what we're wondering about, probably a good question for Business Oregon as compared to Legislative Revenue Office. Some of what you have shown us is comparing the situation for an Oregon taxpayer versus a non Oregon taxpayer. There are projects in Oregon looking for investors, and there are investors looking for projects. And depending on what Oregon does with its incentive programs, and then what other states do, that could impact the situation. Do we know what other states are planning in bills similar to this?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I believe there are bills of this nature across the states, but I don't have a breakdown of where they are within the process or how they disconnect, but I could get that information.
Thank you. I have opened the public hearing. We have several people signed up to testify. The first panel will be John Calhoun and Jody Weiser. After that, we will hear, probably in this order, Stephen Brooks, then Eric Parrish, Joshua Monhey, and after that, Kristen Rutherford and Gwen Baldwin. And Marcia Kelly will be is the last one I have signed up to testify. Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Marsh, Vice Chair Finley, my name is John Calhoun. I'm here today representing Tax Fairness Oregon. As you can see on the slide, in January, Bloomberg Businessweek selected Oregon as the most egregious example in the country for selecting districts for intensive tax breaks that did not need them. This happened because there was Little to no discussion of this provision of the new tax law. It was submitted in the last moment with either no or very limited congressional hearings or debate. There is no discussion in the Oregon legislature because we had 90 days to lock in the districts. And this committee was focused on dealing with the issues from the TCJA pass-through provisions that would have had a immediate and significant impact on the revenue of the state. Oregon selected nearly the entire downtown of its largest city to be eligible for the law's suite of benefits. More than 40% of the important commercial real estate investment during the past 3 years fell within the areas now zoned for the tax breaks, a far higher percentage than any other major U.S. city, according to a recent analysis by Real Capital Analytics. The metro area is not much better. It includes the airport district, which has had considerable investment, Beaverton, including the Nike campus, and Hillsborough, the heart of our booming high-tech industrial growth. Tigard, including Washington Square, and Tualatin, including Bridgeport Mall, all areas that have seen strong investment. Oregon City is the next hot spot for investment in the metro area, is also included. The rest of Oregon seems equally random. Why is Hood River included, but John Day is not? Why is downtown Salem included, but Kaiser is not? Bloomberg put together this chart based on investment rankings on the vertical column and poverty rankings on the bottom column. And you can see that with the exception of that boxed-in score, almost all the districts are either in relatively low poverty areas or high investment areas. This is what the rest of the world is saying. Opportunity zones could be the single biggest tax break in decades. This is the biggest initiative of this type by the federal government with the least debate, the least staff support, the least research, and still the least clarity. This quote is from David Brown, who's the partner setting up a fund for Opportunity Zone investments. The deferral and capital gains tax on an investment rolled into an opportunity fund could be roughly equivalent to cutting that tax bill in half. While the tax savings on a new investment was like getting a 33% more profit. Then he says, because Oregon law conforms with federal tax law, you save on Oregon taxes as well. So, what are we concerned about? Although the initial revenue drain in the next few years will be modest, it should explode at the end of the investment period when all those capital gains that would normally be taxed are no longer taxed. Most of the tax benefits will go to projects already planned or that would happen anyway without any revenue loss. It is just an unneeded gift to the investor class. It will result in overbuilding in Portland and underbuilding in other zones like Klamath Falls, Umatilla, let alone districts that are excluded like John Day that are not on the gravy train. The zones set are arbitrary boundaries that create instant wealth on the inside of the zone while leaving similar properties on the opposite side at a disadvantage. We would like to disconnect entirely. The federal incentives will make most of the investments happen regardless. They do not need an Oregon tax break to use this program. Oregon would not design an incentive program like this, and we shouldn't let the federal government set our tax policy. If you cannot agree to a total disconnect, limiting the tax break to that boxed area of low poverty zone, poverty rates, and low investment would narrow the tax loss and target the investment where it is most needed.
So in the zones that I am, that I know that are on that map, oh, I'm sorry, Jody Weiser speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. There's been lots of investment. I was out with some girlfriends the other night. We were at the Dossier Hotel, and then we were at the Woodlark. those properties were completed just before this law took effect. So the owners of those buildings would not get the benefit. But the things that were being planned at that time and were not yet built would get the benefit, though the benefit to the state of Oregon is not apparent. So there are some investors who had purchased the old Schaefer furniture building on Southeast Grand with the plans of turning it back into a hotel. It had been a hotel in its history. They are still in the planning stages for that. All they have to do is change their ownership structure a little bit, and they'll be benefited for that investment, whereas the people who were in the two hotels I was in Saturday night would not be. And what's it doing for Oregon that we would say you won't pay capital gains on some properties and you will pay capital gains on other properties? And it's all about the timing of an investment that you had nothing to do with the law that gave you that tax break. The federal program has given some properties instant extra value. The Goodmans, for instance, own 12 lots in downtown Portland that several years ago they said, we are planning on now building out those properties. Well, with no capital gains to be paid on investments on those properties, they suddenly became a lot more valuable. And 11 of their 12 properties are inside the opportunity zones in downtown Portland. We're confident that you would never have designed this program. It just doesn't seem like something that we would do. In Oregon, we don't have capital gains tax breaks. We tax all income the same. And it's so arbitrary that it seems totally out of keeping with our values as a state to retain connection to the federal government on this tax provision. And we urge you to disconnect from it. As John said, if you are looking for a way to use it to stimulate in some areas, you could keep those census districts that were in the box. But the census data that was used to develop which census tracts were eligible is the 2010 census data. And obviously things have changed a lot since then. And it still remains very arbitrary. There's in the area where data centers being built like crazy in Prineville, on one side of the street you're inside the census district, on the other side of the street you're not. Well, why would you prefer one building over the other? It doesn't follow. And we urge you to disconnect from this.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have to agree with the gentleman who spoke. When these first were announced, there was a short timeline, and they literally sent out notices to every community throughout the state and said, if you're interested, get a hold of us, referring to Business Oregon. And I think in the end, the department and the governor's office selected, and it was very challenging because one community would say, well, why didn't we get selected over another? At some point in time, it might be worthwhile, Madam Chair, for you to bring the director of the department here just to ask what was the rationale of selecting, pick a community over John Day. Because I'm not sure there was a real rational approach to that decision.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would agree that the only firm rationale that was used that made any sense was, as you looked at the map and scattered around, every Indian reservation had an opportunity zone attached to it. But none of the others made any sense at all. And there was no involvement on this group or any group. I sat in on those conversations, and it was, here you go. It didn't make sense to me. There was a lot of discussion about the Rose Quarter. Why was it selected with all the investment going in and other areas that were not? So, yeah, thank you.
Any other questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Let's hear from Stephen Brooks.
Thank you, Chair Henderson, committee members. My name is Stephen Brooks. I'm an independent consultant. I'm working currently with the Meyer Memorial Trust, Oregon Community Foundation, and the Ford Family Foundation on a program that I'll describe momentarily to help basically direct Opportunity Zone funds into the communities that don't really have capacity at this point to understand how to get access to those kinds of funds. A little apology in the beginning. I'd love to be able to actually address some of the questions that came up about, for example, downtown Portland being selected or being recommended by groups in Portland for inclusion and Opportunity Zone. But I don't think we have time for that, but I'd love to come back and talk about that. And I'm not a huge fan of the legislation. I've worked with New Market Tax Credits for a number of years. It's a very complicated, difficult, kind of wasteful program, but it's a program that people still try and utilize. I'm not going to defend the program. On the other hand, I think the reason I got involved in this with the foundations is because their attitude is the incentive exists. We need to figure out a way to take advantage of it, and in particular to get the resources that are going to come out of this into communities that don't ordinarily have access to this kind of funding. So what I'd like to do is describe the program I'm working on and then give a live example of why I think disconnecting would negatively affect the state. In May 2018, I was hired by the three foundations. They were particularly concerned that rural communities would not see any benefit from this program without some kind of mechanism so that the funds that would become available would be linked up to projects in these communities. We have created a program that we're calling the Oregon Opportunity Zone Initiative. Business Oregon has helped fund the development of this program. The program essentially uses the current 11 economic development district structure. So Oregon is divided into 11 economic development districts. Within each district, we are designating a facilitator who will be responsible for coordinating distribution of Opportunity Zone information to the local communities, and then helping local development agencies direct Opportunity Zone projects into a platform. The purpose of the platform is that project sponsors, and by that I mean developers, businesses, other local facilitators, or project sponsors, put their funds into a platform where the project is reviewed in order to determine whether it meets the Opportunity Zone requirements. With the project gets classified by type, because opportunity funds will invest by type of project. And then it's vetted to ensure that it's at a stage where it is what we're calling investment ready, by which I mean essentially, as an example, because of the timing requirements under the Opportunity Zone program, a project that's 2 years away from being ready to be built is probably too early to attract Opportunity Zone fund money. On the other hand, a project that's 6 to 9 months out to start construction is appealing to opportunity fund investors. We're currently in the process of training the facilitators statewide. We're starting a pilot project for this program next week, using Greater Portland Inc. as the facilitator. Basically, we're going to test out to make sure all of the components work properly. It'll be launched statewide. My target date is April 15th, but we'll see the actual timing. And when I say statewide, I mean that the real focus of this is to work directly with rural communities to help them bring projects up to an equal level of exposure that projects in downtown Portland will receive. And again, the idea is that This is new capital because the incentive is really trying to get people to sell assets that they wouldn't normally sell in order to take advantage. So we consider that new money. And in order to take advantage of the new money availability, communities that don't ordinarily look in the capital markets need some assistance to, one, identify the projects that are going to be utilized, and also to understand how to get access to the capital. From my perspective, there are probably at least three reasons why I think decoupling is probably not a good idea. But rather than go into the details of those, I'd like to give an actual specific example. Thanks for putting it up. So this is basically a schematic of the proper process that we will use going forward. And again, this is going to start the middle of next month. And the basic idea is that the regional economic development organizations will direct project owners, people looking for capital, into a database. And then the project will get reviewed by a third party to see that it's properly in an opportunity zone, that it identify it by type, and then see if it's at a stage where capital can be brought to the project. If the answer is yes, it goes out to directly to fund managers where it gets kind of handed to them. If the answer is no, it's not ready, it kind of gets cycled back to the economic development agencies and the funder to kind of get it ready. The reason I think that the decoupling would be a problem is a specific example with an organization called Enterprise Community Partners. There's another slide here. Enterprise is a national economic development finance organization that funds projects based on community need. This is a term sheet that they're circulating. They want to build what they call workforce housing developments. In their, they define workforce housing as units at 60 to 120% of median family income. They're trying to raise $200 million that they would invest nationwide in these workforce housing projects in opportunity zones throughout the country. They gave us this term sheet because once our platform is in place, we will take that term sheet and distribute it statewide and essentially request that the economic development agencies at the local level identify as many of these projects as they can and direct them into the platform where we can find the ones that are most closely associated with the terms of the term sheet and essentially then bring a portfolio of projects to Enterprise for their money. They're not an Oregon-based fund. They're trying to raise money from opportunity investors across the country. And we see this as an excellent opportunity to bring that money into Oregon and fund a number of these projects kind of simultaneously. The difficulty with decoupling, I didn't bring water. The difficulty with decoupling is that the complexity of trying to manage a fund, an opportunity fund, where you have to separately track basis for Oregon state residents and for the federal taxpayers is complex enough that it's a disincentive for someone like Enterprise. Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. A true public servant. decoupling creates a significant disincentive to people like Enterprise to come to states in Oregon because for every state that decouples, they have to have a separate accounting system to track basis inside the state and outside the state. As a unofficially, their position is they would probably avoid investing in Oregon if Oregon decoupled, in part because there are projects that they will be able to find in states that don't decouple. California is actually considering legislation to add a provision that allows it to track the federal rules. Washington doesn't have income tax. There's a number of states where decoupling is not an issue. And the tax provision is complex enough as it is that national funds, just it's just too much work, you know, and whether that's fair or not, that I think will be the outcome. And what we're trying to do is attract as much capital as possible to the state. And we're also trying to use the platform as a tool to reach out to these local communities, rural communities in particular, and create local mechanisms so that they can link up with other jurisdictions and really try and attract capital at scale. And I think that selfishly, decoupling kind of derails the work we're working on. It makes it much more difficult to link communities and to attract capital. And so I think that for purposes of trying to get the best outcome out of kind of a poorly written law, I think we need to take advantage of it rather than avoid using it. So that's my testimony for today.
Questions, Representative Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it appears to me that this is a if we decoupled, it would be a disincentive for Oregon investors to invest in Oregon investment and opportunity zones because they would lose some of their tax advantages.
Correct.
And what you just said is that it would also be a disincentive for non-resident investors to invest in Oregon funds. So the idea of having the opportunity zones established is now we've taken away some of the incentives, so potential funding for those will perhaps diminish.
I think, and the key is that it's funds, you know, the money has to go through funds. And while it's true that in a number of cases, a developer is going to create a single fund just for one project, there are many national funders and funders outside of the state of Oregon that are developing funds where they will raise money throughout the country and then look for projects in opportunity zones. And there is a disincentive for those funds to invest in states that decouple because it's an added expense for the fund. And it's also they have to explain to their potential investors that, you know, yes, we're going to invest in opportunity zones, but we're going to be investing in states that impose a capital gains tax. And, you know, we'll have to figure out state by state whether it applies to you or not. And the investors have it's like, well, why would I go through that? It's, you know, it's yes, it is a race to the bottom, but our perspective is take advantage of it as best we can rather than step away and essentially not have access to this new capital source. So
I know there are at least two other questions that are hoping to be asked of you. I will ask that the questions and responses be fairly brief because
yes,
we have five more people who would like to present testimony.
Sure.
Representative.
So in three words or less, is it a disincentive for Oregon investors to invest in opportunity zones should this bill pass?
It's a disincentive for Oregon potential investors to sell their assets in the first place.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you. So what I understand that you are doing is essentially creating a clearinghouse to shine light on projects in parts of Oregon that might not otherwise get attention from big investment funds.
Yes, a clearinghouse plus a matchmaking.
So my corollary question to that is, are there ways that we can use this mechanism to really spur projects that have particular public benefit or that really achieve something within our communities?
Certainly. Our real goal over the long term is, regardless of opportunity zone or not, to have local communities create portfolios of projects that they want to see investment and then have a place to bring them so that we can essentially get them underwritten and invested in. So the projects are directed through the communities, not kind of through the private capital markets where the community never really knows what's happening.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here. I respect and understand the job that you're here to do, but I gotta say, I am continually frustrated by the regular parade. This feels like another, oh no, we can't do this. Everyone will leave if we do this here, if we don't give this quadruple discount to indeed the investor class as a previous, not that that's a bad thing, but the idea, and the idea that the federal tax system, which is so complicated now, yet it's not a problem for people to pour through it and do all of those 17 things in order to get that break, but just disconnecting this would make it, oh no, that would make it too complicated. So people, even though people from outside the state who would get no, we would get no tax on anyway by doing this because they wouldn't pay for it. The idea that that makes it too complicated and we shouldn't decouple because, oh, then people wouldn't invest in it because that would be the one tiny bit that made it too complicated for people to invest here. I find that a very troubling argument. I think that's, I just find it troubling. That's all. Sorry, they did not, nope, I did not have a question in there, sorry.
Happy to spend an hour in your office and I'll walk through the whole thing.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Smith.
Yeah, just a statement. I don't disagree with what kind of the good representative to my left has just shared. The one thing, though, that I want to get on the record is we need to keep in mind that these incentives are not special to Oregon alone. Right. And so in California, Nevada, Idaho, Washington, they also have these programs, and what we probably ought to do is take a more in-depth look at what are those states doing as well. Because in the end, especially over in Representative Finley's district, he's really having to compete with economic and industrial development literally 100 yards across a river. And it's very, very real that's going on there. The same in Milton Freewater, the same, I'm assuming, down in Southern Oregon. And so I think we've got to be cautious to make sure we understand what our neighbors are doing as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Next, I'd like to hear from Eric and Joshua from Eugene.
All right. Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, thank you for your time this morning. My name is Eric Parrish, and I'm a CPA and 37-year resident from Eugene, Oregon. And just have a couple of things. Some things have already been talked about, so I'll just be very brief. A few points I wanted to make. There's over 8,700 federal opportunity zones, so less than 1% are in Oregon, so we have 86 of these zones. The Tax Act was, and this provision was actually started in the prior administration. It's been around for a number of years, and it was actually just finalized in 2017. But there's numerous investment opportunities around the United States. And the whole point of this investment and incentives are to rehabilitate, commercial properties and being able to invest in those or build new buildings. So there's the real estate development, the economic development, and there is there's standards of reinvestment of having to improve that property 100% to be able to get some of these incentives. So there's a lot of capital that needs to be placed into some of these investments. The other incentive is for jobs and new businesses, which includes wages, of course. So Oregon wages would come out of some of these. So this could be very good for some different industries in Oregon, technology and medical. These are already distressed communities. So if we could bring some tech jobs to some of these areas or some medical clinics or dental clinics to serve these residents, that would be great. And so that would be some good opportunities to be able to drive some business and turn around some of these areas. So 80 of the 86 zones are in non-large metro areas, and there is some tight standards. I think that there's some interesting things that we haven't talked about already. There's plans have to be made. They've got 30 months to deploy those funds into the construction plans that they have, so there's a lot of planning that does have to happen with these investments. The second point that I want to talk about was, as a CPA, decoupling adds a lot of tax preparation and compliance complexity that Oregon residents do bear the cost of. There's burdensome tax basis differences and calculations, but there's also these programs or these incentives are for 10-year investments or more. Some of these will last through 2047 before they're liquidated. I'll just be wrapping up my career at that point, and there will be a number of businesses and individuals that will change their tax prepare through those years. Errors are made, especially when there's a federal to Oregon tax differences, and so that could have some negative effects as well. Again, thank you for your time, and I really appreciate this.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and members of this committee. My name is Joshua Monahan. I'm from the Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce. I'm the Director of Economic Development. I'm asking that you guys please reevaluate the decoupling program with the following considerations. First, when it comes to Oregon and economic development tools, we don't have a lot of tools compared to other states, and so uncoupling would make us less competitive. On the West Coast, California has decoupled, and Washington has no income or capital gains tax, so trying to see where we compare to them. And for Eugene and smaller cities, they could use such a program as this. The second consideration is it's tax deferred, so there is a due date for the taxes that are deferred. Unlike other tax programs, the capital gains cannot be deferred in perpetuity. And the taxes that are generated from the economic activity, such as payroll taxes and property taxes, would still be generated in those zones. Third point is it's not a traditional windfall tax plan. It's a 10-year investment cycle gain for maximum benefit. It would make sense for people to keep it there for 10 years. Generally, that's one economic cycle. Present cycle kind of is a little bit different than what we normally see. And this investments would be for real estate and for business development. And if the state were to decouple, it would mean that small businesses in those zones would not have access to some of the capital that could be available, and that only the large, wealthier investor class would be able to participate in this program. Fourth, this program definitely bolsters the tech community. If you look at a tech business and where it is after 10 years, they do grow pretty significantly if they survive the first 5 years and 7 years. But this also supports local businesses in many areas. Other sectors that would benefit would be professional services. We could see people moving to those low-income communities. Right now, there were 300 zones that were up for consideration based on the original initiation of the plan. 86 of them qualified, and 80 of them are not in Portland, with Eugene having three and Lane County having a total of five. And then the fifth consideration is the nature of the program. The idea was that the investors with significant portfolios would divest their stocks and provide capital to the local community, essentially, as a person before said, new money. So in wrapping up this piece that I'm putting out here, please reconsider the bill in its current form and either stay coupled to the federal program or decouple in a measured way that addresses valid concerns in parity with other states that have also partially decoupled. I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Kristen and Gwen.
It's like empowerment zones of the 90s. Didn't really empower anyone, right?
Please, we just need to get on. Yep, please. Thanks.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Finley and Marsh, and members of the committee. My name is Gwen Baldwin, and I'm here this morning representing Oregon Smart Growth. We are a coalition of developers, investors, and allied professions committed to the feasible development of walkable, livable communities that are environmentally, socially, and economically sustainable. As you've heard, House Bill 2144 disconnects Oregon from the Federal Opportunity Zone Program. And regardless of how one feels about federal policymaking these days, I should note that this act had bipartisan support. The effect of this bill, however, is to disadvantage Oregon investors and Oregon communities across our state. Construction costs in the West are incredibly high, and we are seeing a significant slowing of projects and a tightening of capital. Investors with opportunity funds, and again, new capital gain money, are alternative sources for capitalizing projects where banks and other financing institutions may limit what they will fund. And after investment holdings are sold, the Opportunity Zone program encourages reinvestment in new projects within these zones. These projects generate jobs short and long term. They build housing in a state with 155,000 unit shortfall across affordability levels and bring new economic energy to rural and urban communities in 86 zones across Oregon. The zones were carefully selected by the governor's office, be it in limited time, to bring investment dollars into communities in specific low-income census tracts where there is both opportunity to leverage existing attributes and strengthen the local economy. Oregon investors know the state and their communities and look forward to making a difference. In the Gresham area, there's a small group of small business people looking to pool their investment to create housing for the employment needs of that area. In the industrial area of Near and Eastside Portland, a project is being pulled together to create industrial maker space. And nearby, a housing hotel project is only able to continue development because of Opportunity Zone funding from Oregonians. And they are now strongly leaning toward opting into inclusionary housing, adding units with 99-year affordability at 60% area median income, something that would be a non-starter without Opportunity Zone funding. Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, I appreciate the pressures you face to increase overall revenue and the challenging but needed conversations to come on overall revenue reform. At the same time, existing federal mechanisms provide deferral for capital gains, whether it's the like exchange that already exists for property or the Opportunity Zone program. But if a gain is never realized because the stocks or other assets are never sold to invest in communities, the revenue upside to the state will be modest. But the loss of investment in Oregon communities by Oregonians will be felt for years to come. I urge your no vote on House Bill 2144. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and committee members. I'm Kristen Rutherford, and I'm here representing the Oregon Economic Development Association as past president, as co-chair of their Governmental Affairs Committee. OEDA is made up of representation from cities around the state and economic development organizations from around the state. I am also the urban development director here in the city of Salem. OEDA opposes HB 2144. And the League of Oregon Cities has also submitted a letter opposing this bill. And Wendy Johnson of the League is an OEDA member, and she's been working with us to understand the bill and the impact to our communities. Most of Oregon's opportunity zones are in rural areas and incentivize local people to invest capital in these small rural communities. Oregon's 86 opportunity zones are already generating positive interest in towns across our state. Here in Salem, we have four opportunity zones. And we currently have four separate groups that I'm currently aware of looking at investing in our community because of these benefits. These are Oregon citizens and businesses choosing to invest locally. These projects are at various stages of exploration and development, with some likely under construction in the next 9 months. None of these projects were in the works prior to last summer. They came about because of the Opportunity Zone benefit. The locations being considered are properties that have been vacant ranging from a year up to well over a decade. And some are what would absolutely be considered blighted and derelict and hard to develop properties. The types of project range from projects that would be job creators to housing, and all would benefit the community and increase property tax revenue. State surplus property at Hillcrest is in one of our opportunity zones. And this benefit makes this property far more attractive for investment than it would be otherwise given its infrastructure challenges. One of the pending investments here, should it come to fruition, would result in approximately 150 new workforce housing units in our downtown. Given the housing shortage in the state, OEDA sees a need for new housing at all levels, and while affordable and low-income housing is certainly needed and a top priority, we also need workforce and market-rate housing units. And opportunity zones incentivize investment in workforce and market rate multifamily housing. My colleagues around the state are seeing similar interest in their cities. And around the state, we are seeing the potential for properties to come back to life and be assets in our community because of the Opportunity Zone incentive. OEDA is concerned that disconnecting from the federal code will penalize Oregon investors by treating Oregon investors differently. HB 2144 will not give Oregonians investing in their own communities the same benefits as those who invest elsewhere or out-of-state investors spending the same money in our communities. We believe this would deter investment in our neediest areas. Oregon has very few tools to incentivize economic development and investment in our communities compared to other states. Those who work around the state in this field ask you to not approve this bill or decouple Oregon from the federal program. We believe this would harm our communities and our prospects for new job growth, new housing, and new capital. Thank you.
Are there questions for this panel?
Thank you. The final speaker will be Marcia Kelly.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Marsh and Findlay, members of the committee, I'm Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. And most of the time this session, you've been hearing me get up and say, no, don't give away this tax break. This time I'm going to say yes, decouple. And it comes for some varying reasons. I've spent a lot of time since 2004 investigating the New Market tax credits based on census tracts that have high poverty to get investment in. And in Oregon, we had investment between 2004 and 2011 in New Market tax credits of $651 million plus dollars. And why did I pick that break? Well, because in 2011, after three sessions, we finally could not stop a local New Market tax credits in Oregon to add to the federal New Market tax credits. So we had $651 million worth of investments before we put in a special additional tax break. And in the 2012 to 2016 period of time for New Market tax credits, we had $287 million worth of investments. Did we need a state New Market tax credits? They were coming anyway. And I see this as the same thing. They will come. On one of the websites for people who are aggregating money and talking about the opportunity zones, Portland is the number six target on their investment list. Their investments are all in, of course, multiple metropolitan areas. And I would also like to suggest that you go to the Community Development Investment Fund website that covers opportunity zones and look at the list of Oregon selected sites. I just counted 31 in Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas counties out of the 86. So I'm thinking that we need to really look at that closely. The IRS has not finalized regulations on this program yet, so I would not be surprised if they might extend the 2026 year, just because it has taken some time. They have not finalized them, partially because of the government shutdown, but they also are having a hard time dealing with this. One of the other people testifying said that the people who set up investments in Oregon would have to track Oregon and out-of-state investors differently. And I don't think I believe that that is truly the case, because if you invest and make money in Oregon, you become an Oregon taxpayer. My spouse has a family LLC. His sister in Chicago pays Oregon taxes. His sister in Virginia pays Oregon taxes on the money from the LLC. And if the state of Washington does not have an income tax, they would not be taxing capital gains tax. People investing in Washington would not get an additional state credit because there isn't an income tax. Now, Governor Inslee has talked about putting in the capital gains tax as an excise tax. And what I read about that was mainly people saying, see you in court, because an income tax is an income tax. We think that you should decouple from this provision because we don't think it is necessary. And I'd be happy to share even more data with people because I've been working on new market tax credits, somewhat similar to this, almost similar to this, since 2004.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Smith.
Just very briefly, I'd share with you a very good point was made in that the IRS has not finalized its rulemaking, and there still is a tremendous amount of confusion, even within the state of Oregon, within Business Oregon, and in local communities as to how this program operates. And so this is when we just kind of, I would strongly encourage that we be careful how we proceed forward, because there's a lot of unknown on this.
Any questions? Thank you. There is no one else who had signed up to testify. No other business. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2144, and we are adjourned.